Mabuff!
This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. A big thank you to everyone who submitted both charming and extraordinarily creepy reviews and fan art over the past week. You can see some of them on the Facebook page at Honest Con Man. Just a reminder that in the next few weeks, we will be reviewing and looking at the movie F is for Fake, the 1970s Orson Welles classic. If you haven't seen the movie, I highly recommend that you check it out. Not only is it a great film to see, you will enjoy the podcast all the more when we get around to actually looking at the movie. Simon Caterson has come back to talk about it, and the podcast is an absolute treat. And now, on with the show. Scammapalooza spends a lot of time looking at the inner workings of the con artist's mind, thinking about how they did it, how they got away with it, and what we'd do if we were in their position. Very rarely, however, do we think about the victims, the people who lose their money to swindlers, and what they do next. My guest on the podcast today is Jan Marshall, a woman who, in 2012, lost over $250,000 to an online swindler. However, Jan hasn't let this tragedy get the better of her and now spends her time sharing her story with the world so that other people can learn not only what it's like to be swindled, but what they can do to stop it from happening again. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. Thank you so much for joining me, although you didn't have far to travel. We're now neighbours. That's very nice.
Living very close.
Yeah. You're not from Melbourne, though, originally, are you? Where did you from
originally? Yes, I am from Melbourne, as I grew up here from the age of 8 to 17, my major formative years. But I then went off to ANU, to university, and ended up, you know, living in many different places, including Alice Springs, Adelaide, Sydney, Byron Bay, but the last stint away was 6 years working in Brisbane.
What did you study at ANU? I'm an ex-ANU person myself. Yeah, I'm from Canberra originally.
I did psychology and politics in the early 70s.
Oh, right. I'm a sociology boy, so similar but not quite. So you understand the human brain?
Yes, a little bit. I've also since trained as a social worker. So all of my study and work has been around, in a sense, helping people. Even though, you know, at times when I was selling computers before they were called PCs in the early 80s, I always saw my job as helping people to do what they needed to do better and improving the quality of their life through all of that.
Yeah, so selling computers, studying psychology, working as a social worker, traveling all around Australia. You've lived in every state then?
Not WA.
No, but who would? Why would you?
I don't know. I'd like to try that sometime.
I'm off. My mother is from Perth, and yeah. Every time I go over there, it's this weird thing of being in this completely foreign land, but also somewhere that I'm from. That, you know, this is where my relatives are from. But no, I understand avoiding Perth. Yeah. Have you been married before all of this happened?
No. And you know, strangely, I found that most of my life I was not in relationships. Certainly from the early 80s, there was really nothing significant in terms of relating to people prior to that, both men and women, at different times. But there was a long drought in my life of having that close, intimate relationship.
Yeah. But at the same time, you clearly just talking to you, you're clearly someone who likes people and likes being around people and talking to them.
Yes, absolutely.
And helping them. Excellent. So I guess that all makes you, even though you're clearly someone who has a lot of life experience and intelligence, it does make you seem like someone who would be open to this type of scam, the kind of combination of inexperience but also the desire to help other people.
Yes, and I guess in terms of the openness at this specific time, I had just moved to Melbourne. Though most of my family is down here, I didn't have a friendship network that, say, I had up in Brisbane. And really, I was looking for companionship to re-explore Victoria, because I know there's a lot of lovely things around here to go and see and do, and I wanted somebody to do that with, because it's not so much fun doing it on your own.
Yeah.
So that meant I was open to something. in a way I probably wouldn't have been otherwise.
And that's something I go to a lot of meetup groups, which I know you've been to a few of as well, and they're a great opportunity to just to meet people randomly. Like you can join a meetup group and then within, you know, look and see what's happening tonight with this group, and you can be hanging out with 20 strangers in a bar somewhere, watching comedy or going to an art gallery or doing all sorts of extraordinary things. So it seems the internet is definitely a way to cut through a lot of social red tape and just find people instantly.
It's certainly a way of meeting people, but it's not necessarily so easy to go from that meeting to developing a friendship.
Yeah.
You know, for me, I find I've got to have some constancy of contact and reason for contact to develop a friendship.
Oh, yeah, I'm the same.
Yes.
Because you have those friends that you see them, like people you might work with, or like most of my friends are people that I work with.
Same.
I see all the time.
Same.
And I have some close friends who aren't in my business, but they're very, very long-term friends. Yes. And other people just kind of drift away, don't they, after?
And because I've moved around a lot, I do tend to keep contact with friends, you know, sometimes via Facebook. But I've got a couple of girlfriends that I have from my Sydney years, which is, you know, early 80s, that I have a regular three-way phone call with every 5 to 6 weeks. And we spend an hour and we have 20 minutes each to tell what's going on with us for the past period. And I've been doing that with them since about 2000. So long term, and, you know, so that's that constancy that I think is important in building friendships.
You mentioned working with computers before they were called PCs, and you're obviously someone who is, you know, you arrive in a new city and the first thing you do is go online. So you're clearly someone who's tech savvy, like you, yes, you understand technology and have kept up to date. When the internet first sort of blew up, because I was sort of a teenager when the internet first became something not just that existed, but that became every day. Did you immediately gravitate to it as a way of communicating as someone who, you know, as it travels a lot?
Not necessarily. I mean, when do you say that the internet started? 1992?
The 5th of June, 1992, when they flipped on the switch. Yeah.
Yes. Certainly prior to that and since that time, I was using emails very actively, yes. That would have been certainly a way to stay in contact. And at times when I was, you know, in different cities or travelling, certainly, you know, I remember when was it? Probably 92 when I went over to India for a while and I stayed in an ashram over there for a little bit. You know, already emails were a primary form of communication during that sort of period. So, yes, that's certainly a way. Prior to that, probably long letters.
Yeah.
You know, so there is that sort of written communication form, which is a, you know, very clear way of communicating.
And also, I've completely forgotten the woman's name, but we were on we met on an interview on ABC local radio, yes, and there was a woman who was a psychologist. Was also there, whose name has completely escaped me. She was absolutely lovely, lovely
me
woman.
Me too.
Well, I don't feel so terrible if you've forgotten as well. But she talked about how the written word is quite intoxicating. That there's
and certainly that's one of the things that attracted me to this person was that they were articulate and they were expressing themselves. And we have a cultural thing that men aren't so good at that. And certainly online you see it because a lot of the profiles that you see are pretty basic online. So to have somebody who was actually engaging, starting and wanting to engage, was very appealing.
What website did you go to?
I went to one called Plenty of Fish, mm-hmm, because I was, in a sense, feeling like I was just dipping my big toe in the water. I didn't really want to spend money.
Yeah.
And that's one that you don't have to spend money on. It probably also means ultimately that, you know, there's not a lot of checking of profiles to see whether they're real or not by the actual website.
And
this is something I've learned in hindsight, of course.
Oh, yeah, that's hindsight. Yeah. What is What year was this? Like, when did
this was 2012 when I came back to Melbourne. Mm-hmm. Arrived mid-year, started a job immediately. Lived around the corner in another house in Preston. Yes, 2012.
Right. So this is pre-Tinder, and internet dating was certainly popular 3 years ago now.
Yes.
But it was not something that was so ubiquitous that everyone talked about and everyone did.
Oh, they were starting to. It was very much a thing of, you know, to meet somebody, you know, certainly being in the country, RSVP was the first one that was well known and well used, I think, around Australia. People not necessarily realising that there were many other companies doing it. I think in those days, eHarmony was out there as another one to go to, and, you know, they have a big sort of questioning process that you go through to set up a profile on eHarmony, and I know at one stage I had started that. But because I hadn't had a lot of experience with relationships, I hadn't explored that area much at all,
mm-hmm.
so I was fairly naive going online about the dangers and what happens and what it's like on there.
Yeah. And so what was the identity that you were presented with?
The identity, the name I had was Eamon Douglas Dublain, Dublain, an Irish name. I can't even remember the age now. Engineer, at that stage living in America, but based in Manchester in England. And, you know, that's, again, one of the red flags is the engineer provides them the ability to so-called travel and be in different places.
Yeah, but also it's a traditional job they're not a backpacker or something.
Yes, that's exactly right. And for me, it means they're intelligent, they're capable, they're educated, they're well paid. You know, those are the sorts of things that I would find attractive in anyone.
Was there a photograph?
Yes.
What did he look like?
There was a couple of photographs initially. And the one that probably struck me was attractive looking grey haired man in a very nice, loose, obviously very good quality white shirt, a summer shirt.
Yeah.
You know, not a fitted shirt, but, you know, a nice light cotton shirt. You know, very attractive.
And that sounds like you can imagine him off travelling around the world, going to these glamorous places, a kind of neo-colonial sort of character.
That's yes.
Visiting all these wonderful places.
Yes, there was also a photo of him obviously on a yacht and a couple of other, you know, over the time a couple of other photos were revealed.
Have you discovered who he, the man in the photograph, was? Do you know where the photographs came from or who he was?
Look, at the time I realised I'd been scammed, I started finding out how to do Google searches on images.
Mm.
I found, of those four photos, I found those four photos on at least 10 other websites being used. Mostly that was, there was a university alumni, numerous other dating type sites or social type sites, all of them with different names. Only last year when I started going public with the impact of this, one of the big international newspapers did an article and that got picked up in the UK, and I was contacted at that time by somebody who said they were his daughter, and could I please not say that he was a scammer?
Oh, cool.
Now, I only ever had a first name, mm-hmm. and I've had no more contact.
That is something that I've never considered, is that the person whose name, whose photograph is used for the scam, is not just being used for the scam, it's then, once it's exposed, that person is having their photograph plastered all over the internet and all over the media with
yes.
this man is a scammer. And the general public is not not prone to.
Yes, I mean,
you know, separate.
It's most of the articles are fairly clear that the photos are stolen photos, but it's really important that that gets really spelled out clearly.
Yeah.
And we're not sort of, you know, importuning the man in the photo.
Yeah.
We're importuning the probably young black Nigerian who's behind that photo.
Yeah, who looks completely different. Yes. And is a completely different person.
Yes.
So Amos was his first name?
Amon.
Amon, sorry.
Yes.
So Amon, what did you talk about in the early days?
In the early days it was email exchange and... in those times, you know, he would sort of send me a letter of a whole lot of likes, you know, so this is the things I like, you know, I like Mexican food or, you know, and certainly including some things about relationship in there. Mm-hmm. And the invitation was to then sort of write back, you know, what do you like about all of these sorts of things? And certainly a way to get to know each other, and I took it on face value as that. He did sort of get me off the dating site quite quickly, which is one of the red flags, that they will try and get you away from that site and then they will close down their profile, and he certainly did that. He did it telling me that he just wanted to communicate with me.
Yeah.
So they're very clever at making it, you know, all about them wanting to be with you, me.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that also enables them to separate you and them from any internal structures that website
yes.
might have for protecting people from fraud.
Yes.
Because they don't know you're continuing a relationship with the person.
Yes.
And what did you like about him?
It's hard. It's going back a few years now. But certainly, as I said before, the fact that he was articulate,
mm-hmm.
that he was expressing himself. You know, gradually over time it was saying, you know, it's more about responding to each other rather than just sharing of yourself. And, you know, it's about the, you know, oh, I like what you're saying about this. And certainly for me to him. And I think they're very good at picking up on some of the clues from those sorts of things. So in a psychological term, I think they then lead you and pace you
mm-hmm.
and come back with liking the things you like. And so that sort of sets up a, you know, a situation where they can start to say as they do, oh, I really like you. I only want to communicate with you. And eventually very quickly going into, you know, how do I describe it? I just want to have more contact with you. I like you. And then it's, I think we're meant to be together.
Yeah.
You know, and it's destiny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this destiny thing is very, very important in their leading the way it's meant to be. So they keep pulling you closer to the relationship and we're going to be together sort of scenario.
Are you someone who before this kind of believed in the idea of destiny and love at first sight and that two people can meet and there's meant to be together?
Not from any experience of relationship, as I've said, but I think there's always the romantic myth that is promulgated out there in society that, you know, this is the way it happens, that there is a soulmate for each of us. And they build up on those sorts of things. Women like that stuff. I liked that stuff. Mm. I can't say in the past I would have, but I was certainly pulled into believing that. And I know at one stage my sense of what was happening was that it was very archetypal, as in how you would imagine a perfect interaction between a man and a woman. And they are skilled at putting that together. You know, that's the trick. They are very skilled at doing everything a woman might think they want in a man. You know, and that sort of goes on in emails initially, then in going on to a chat program of some sort, you know, Messenger or something like that, and then webcam.
And so once you, how long did you sort of talk to him online before he sort of started to talk about webcams and that type of thing?
Probably, I remember it was not long after we started talking, he went from America back to Manchester. So there was a bit of time in Manchester, and at that time we were already beginning to talk on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think chat at that stage.
So when you spoke to him on the phone, what did he sound like? Like what was the voice that you heard?
He had set that up specifically as well, and what he or they will often do is do a mixed heritage to confuse the accent issue.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, he said his mother was Russian and his father was Irish. That's what the name is, quite Irish, yeah? So you can imagine that somebody growing up in that mixed idiom is going to have a different accent.
Yeah.
So the accent was a bit different, but because of that, it didn't strike me as inconsistent.
Yeah, because there is no. I mean, if you said, "What does an Italian Australian sound like?" I'd go, "Oh yeah, I've got an image in my head." But if you say a Russian Irish accent, there's nothing to compare it to.
Yes.
That's fascinating.
And I noticed that on a lot of the profiles there is that mixed heritage.
Mm.
And that's how they sort of cover up the accent issues.
Yeah, there's also because there's the third culture kids, which are the children who have parents might be diplomats or work for companies and travel around the world. And because they spend all their time in international schools, they all end up with the same accent. And
yes.
So you can have children from that have grown up in various different countries and they all have this same... Yes. Pseudo-American accent, this kind of soft California voice that...
And if I thought about it now, I'd probably say, well, if he grew up in Ireland, he probably should have an Irish accent. But it was enough of a confusion of my sense of what would be right, because I don't... Never been to Ireland, spent a little time in England, never been with Russian people, so I wouldn't actually know what the accent was. And they rely on that confusion.
Yeah, and I think we're also trained not to tell people that their accent doesn't sound right. Like, no one ever sort of meets someone for the first time and goes, "Oh, you sound funny, what's that about?" Like, it's impolite.
I did have a lady tell me that somebody was supposedly Italian, or there's some element of Italy in there, and she knew immediately that the accent was wrong.
Oh, so that was a giveaway, because she knew there was nothing Italian about this person.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, it is.
So it can work if you know. But again, in those questions up front, they get to know enough about you to be able to confuse you. So I remember one of the questions was, for example, do you know anybody in England? And I was able to say, no, not, you know, I've got a friend who's there, but really don't know. That means that they can base themselves in England. They can tell stories about England, and I wouldn't know the difference.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're very skilled at putting those little leading questions into that big long list of things you like or dislike. And finding out things that they can then position themselves around you, you know, you to confuse you or to get past whatever cynicism you might have.
And what did you think and feel as this went on? Did you feel like this was destiny and that you were going to be together and you did fall in love with Eamon?
Yes, absolutely.
And how long did that take? Like how long?
About a month.
Okay.
The whole interaction with him was only 72 days.
Mm-hmm.
So about a month in was, by this time he was saying he had got a contract in Dubai, and he was going off to Dubai to do a 6 to 8 week contract doing some maintenance on some oil pipelines. And he was then going to come on to Australia to meet me.
And that, I imagine, is when the trap snaps yes. shut. That's when he makes his move.
Yes, and prior to that, it's really a leading question about, you know, if a man is in love with you and you think you are in him, are with him, will you marry him?
So not saying would you marry me?
But the leading question that absolutely gets you into that position.
Yeah, that's
And so then regarding him as my fiance, him talking about me as his fiance.
Yeah, without ever explicitly saying it, just asking the question.
Yes.
Like a sort of move a teenage boy would make, like
yes.
wanting to ask out a girl but not wanting to, you know, specifically ask her out.
But that gentleness with that
yeah.
is quite touching as mm. well. I was expecting the question.
Mm-hmm.
So he had led me on enough for me to be expecting that question and obviously was confident of the answer. And it's interesting because in some of my research, there was a fabulous article that I've written about in my blog, and it describes how scammers regard this point as taking the brain. When you agree to marry, they know they have got you absolutely hooked,
mm.
and they can then ask anything.
We had Arthur Maines, who's a psychologist, on the show a few months ago, and he talked about elder fraud. So it's specifically people who are people's grandparents,
yes.
and who've been scammed. And he talked a lot about the idea that the human brain is like a little girl riding an elephant, and that once the little girl can, you know, lead the elephant where it's going to go, but once the elephant starts rampaging, once it takes off
yes.
In the direction of sort of irrational behaviour, there's nothing the little girl, the little rational yes. girl on top can do about it.
Yes.
And it sounds like he got you to that point.
Absolutely.
So how did he bring up the subject of money? How did that first come up?
It first came up around that he hadn't realised that by working in Dubai, he needed to prepay some taxes. So he was getting me on the business level. I had some cash, and it was, you know, most of these scams are they've got money but they can't access it, and that was the story here. He supposedly had money in England, but because there'd been a stop on his money because he'd made that money through selling oil, in Britain there was a stop on it because they were checking out whether it was money laundering.
Mm-hmm.
So close to the truth, it's not funny. So supposedly had money that he couldn't access, and so it was always a loan and temporary till he could get access to that money. So for me, that was a real point of decision about whether I would assist him. And I thought about that long and hard. I had been warned by people that there are scammers there, but actually hadn't taken it in.
Yeah.
But I knew the stuff about you don't give money.
Mm.
And yet I felt compelled to do that, and I did it partly because for me that space of being in love was so strong. I wanted to do it out of that space and not be somebody who operates out of fear and cynicism and skepticism. So I made a clear decision to do it out of love. In hindsight, I realized that state of being in love was absolutely manipulated. You know, that was generated in me by people who professionally manipulated my emotions. But at that point, I did it out of love. So, and it was to a bank, though not necessarily a bank in his name, but going to a bank, that also felt
yeah.
a bit secure and a bit realistic.
You weren't being asked to sort of leave small unmarked bills in a paper bag somewhere.
No.
Or even Western Union or any of those kind of other warning signs.
I mean, there were other things that went via Western Union, but it didn't matter because, you know, that first one was the key decision for me.
Yeah. And how much money were you asked to give at that initial?
I think the first amount was quite a large amount. Mm-hmm. I think it was actually about $30,000.
Wow.
The difficulty is that it went on from there.
Yeah.
But yes, I felt so strongly about this man at this time that I paid him that money.
And had there been leading questions about the 30, you know, about how much money you have and your...
Not directly, but there was talk about investment in housing. I had put on my profile that I was interested in property investing.
Right.
Little fool me. You know, it had come up in the in some of those, you know, multiple question emails. There had been talk, and I think it was prior to this, but I can't be quite clear, but certainly ongoing, about, you know, he was coming and he was saying to me, start looking for a house for us to buy. And that, you know, when I'm querying, he was querying how much deposit I had. I think I might have said I'd been thinking of buying a house down here, so there were questions about that.
Yeah.
And then as he was talking about, you know, buying a house, you know, again, pacing me with those questions about buying a house, he was certainly saying he had plenty of money.
So it's as if, it's almost as if there is a mathematical equation that they can do, almost like a loan agent might do when going for a home loan, of figuring out exactly how much you can afford to give and how in love you are and how connect, you know, and they sort of settled on the number of $30,000 was the number they could ask you for that much money.
Maybe. Yes. Maybe there is an equation there. I don't know. That, you know, I know so many people that I've come across, though, who have borrowed money to pay for whatever it is, whether it's, you know, to get gold or get an inheritance or whatever. People borrow money. So it's not a question of what money you have. And they obviously don't care how you get hold of the money as long as you get hold of some.
Yeah.
So there might have been some assessment of me, absolutely. There might have been just a testing out,
Yeah, because a lot of the time you hear about them asking for very small amounts of money to begin with and then slowly increasing it. So it's surprising that they started just straight out with the big money.
They really
sort of took a gamble. What did you think when it didn't, you know, that he didn't arrive and he didn't come, you know, immediately back, and that suddenly there were requests for more money? Did that make you suspicious, or did it make you double down on your affections?
I think the time after that, it was actually a miscalculation on some materials he needed, and that was a small amount of money. I totally went along with him, basically. There was another one where they use other people to set it up very specifically. So, for example, I had talked to his supposed 16-year-old daughter who was with him, supposedly, in Dubai. You know, and then she rings one night saying there's some men in the apartment and they're, you know, bullying her dad, and she's very frightened. And it turns out that was people coming back and say, well, you paid the first half of the taxes, but you had 2 weeks to pay the second half of the taxes, and now they were demanding it forcefully.
Yeah.
So they generate scare and they generate urgency.
Yeah, the urgency sounds like it's an important part of it.
Absolutely.
You've got to make, you need to make a decision, but you've got to make a decision quickly.
Yes.
So the amounts of money obviously started to go up, and you started to sort of increasingly give more money.
Yes. So that was a $40,000 amount of taxes, which I paid to him via Western Union in $10,000 lots, because the limit is $10,000. And here's me going to the general post office in Melbourne, paying three to four lots of $10,000 amounts via Western Union with not a question asked.
Yeah, this is something that I am constantly surprised by. I've never been able to figure out Western Union as an organisation, in that they know and are aware of how much money goes through them for fraud. Like they,
yes, and they have on the front of their form, watch out for this. So they've tried to put it up front there. I wasn't reading that though.
No.
It wasn't till later that I actually realised that this was on the front of their forms. That's how blind I was. That's how the rational side of me was so disengaged during all of this. So there were constant requests for money over this time. And so this is probably over a period of 4 or 5 weeks. I paid over $260,000. I took extra money on my credit card to do this. I got another credit card and took $15,000 off that. And then I started taking money out of my self-managed super fund illegally. You're not allowed to take money out of your superannuation. I was 3 months prior to the sort of age, so the difficulty there was that I had just set it up. I was about to invest in property in my self-managed super fund and I had access to the bank account. Normally you don't have access to your super fund, but at that stage I did. So out of my sense of desperation to get him out of the situation so he could leave, whether it was to go back to England or to come on to me, I was paying this money. Now, that $40,000, he went off to pay and supposedly got robbed by the taxi driver, robbed and beaten up by the taxi driver. So then I actually had to give him another $40,000. Had to. I don't know, but did. Yeah,
and you just, I mean, it sounds like you had, by this point, I mean, you mentioned you'd left, you said that, I think you used the phrase, left it up to him. It sounds like you had given over the decision-making ability to him to an extent, that you'd sort of stopped making the conscious decision yourself. Is that accurate? Or?
I was fulfilling the requests, and as I would come away from sending that money, I would think, is this a scam? Could this possibly be a scam? And I would, in my mind, say, no, I don't believe it is a scam because I don't believe the scam would have this level of intimacy.
Mm.
I don't believe a scam would have the interaction with the daughter. So I was able, whether that was rational or not, to justify it not being a scam and that it must be real.
At what point did you realise did you start to get suspicious, that you started to think that this was a scam?
Rationally, I didn't accept that it was a scam. You know, later there was even on the way to the airport, he has a car accident and it drops off the radar for a couple of days. And then there's the call from a nurse saying he's here in hospital and his daughter is hospital and the car driver's been killed. And, you know, then there's the requests for medical money to pay medical bills. And I said, well, get in touch with the embassy. You know, they should be able to help you. And I actually rang the British embassy, who looked for his name and didn't find it, and said, this is probably a scam. Even though they said that, I didn't accept that that was the case. I said, oh, he must be on an Irish passport. There must be some reason where they wouldn't find him. So I was able to justify myself out of that, and I continued to pay money. At that stage, I was right at the very end and didn't have much to pay, but I continued to pay money right till the very end. And it wasn't until he cut contact that I realised that I'd been scammed, that I actually faced up to the fact that I'd been scammed.
And did that happen all at once? Was it a sudden realisation, or did it take you time to come to terms with that?
So finally, after me paying some medical expenses and some last-minute accommodation and ticket expenses, he supposedly got on a plane to go back to England. I, you know, expected as soon as he landed in England he would contact me. He didn't. You know, I said, oh, he was waiting for the bank to open. Then he'll send me my money back. You know, I was desperate to get that money back. And remember that all this time I was thinking it was a loan and I would get my money back. So it took probably a couple of days to realise that he wasn't contacting, and I'd say he flew on maybe the Saturday, maybe the Tuesday. I realised this wasn't happening, that there'd been no contact. He wasn't sending me my money back and that I'd been scammed. I can't remember whether it was a Tuesday or the Wednesday that I actually spoke to my mum about it, that it really hit me that it was a scam.
And what did you do?
Started speaking to my close confidants, my mother, a couple of girlfriends, particularly the girlfriends who'd warned me. Didn't really know what else to do at that stage. I was in an emotional mess, as you can imagine. I did the following weekend go and report it to the Victorian police. They took my story, but really that's all they did. Didn't know what else to do, really. What I did do was start writing the sequence of what had happened because I couldn't understand it myself. So I spent, you know, some time over the next 3 months going through all of the emails, messages, all the records I had to sort of work out a diary, a timeline of what had happened. And gradually over the time also began to research scams. And it wasn't until I, a couple of things. One, found those photos under 10 different names on the site romancescam.com. I actually did some, I found the photos on there. And so it was clear that it was, you know, photos being used by scammers and a number of different names associated with that. And also did some searching on some of the text in some of the emails and found stories that were very, very similar to mine. You know, and when you are faced with that, you realise, this is how I describe it, that it's not personal. It was never about me.
Yeah. And it, was that comforting or was that more distressing?
It certainly led to me to really understand that it was a scam. It doesn't help because all of those sites say you're unlikely to get your money back.
Yeah.
You know, so the money side of it was very distressing. Emotionally, certainly for the first sort of month, I was in pretty much a mess emotionally. Still working, though. You know, if I didn't have the work as some stability for me, I would have been in dire straits, I imagine. I did get some counselling from using my employer free counselling service, just one session at least, because I needed to go and talk to somebody. Comforting or not, I can't say. I can't quantify it in those terms, really.
Yeah. So what was the, I mean, what was the final amount? Like, how much did you lose?
$260,000 I gave, plus about another $10,000 in fees. So it probably came up over $270,000. However, the next leg of the journey was a little bit later because I actually self-disclosed to the ATO that I had taken this money. They investigated and said it was uncompliant to do that. and that I must close the fund, which I was going to do anyway because there was no money left in it. So I closed the fund, and then finally they said, okay, that amount of money that you took from that fund, which was $166,000, we are going to insist that you claim that in your personal tax and pay at a top marginal rate of 46.7% tax on that money. So that gave me an additional tax bill of $76,000.
And this is after you've already been scammed. You've got now the tax office chasing you for money. Yeah. Isn't there some sort of I don't know. I know that if you have, you know, mental health things, or if you have, you know, hardship issues, and so, I feel like there's got to be some sort of special dispensation in that.
I did get some legal help to approach the tax office to ask for what they call discretion. Now, in my mind, discretion would mean, well, maybe they'll have some compassion for my circumstances. The first letter to them was pretty legalistic in terms of trying to say that I was close to an age where I could have taken it out, was only ever taken out as a loan. So it addressed it from a rational perspective. You know, it certainly said I'd been scammed, but it tried to give all of these other justifications for that. The ATO came back and said they didn't accept it was a loan because there was no documentation of that, because it was actually a loan to myself. I took it out to myself, so they didn't actually take the scam stuff into account. And what was the words they used in it? So basically, so they said discretion was not allowed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they said the fact that it was a scam was noted. Now, the next step in the process was to write an objection to that finding. I decided to not go through the legal realms at that stage because I didn't have any money to pay anymore for the legal.
Yeah.
The last lot of legal stuff I'd put on my credit card.
Yeah.
So I decided to write it myself, and so I did a lot more research, and by this time I'm getting into a lot of the stuff about scamming and how much it's happening and all of that sort of stuff. And I wrote a letter that was a lot more personal, saying, basically saying, during that period I was so much caught in the scam that I was not responsible for what I was doing, and that scamming is, you know, professional criminal behaviour, that is the emotional manipulation. So I really got a clear understanding through writing, having to write that letter, what was going on in the scam.
Yeah.
And wrote an objection, quite a good objection, I think, to that. They came back again saying no, they wouldn't accept that objection. The implications I got from it was that may have been handled, they may have been treated a bit more sympathetically. However, I had not provided any medical evidence that I was not in control of myself during that period, and that there was no precedent. They were the two reasons.
Right.
Now, I started thinking about whether I could get, you know, a medico-legal report saying that I was not in control. But most of those medico-legal reports are commissioned by lawyers. So to have somebody commission it on their own volition was a bit different for them. And again, cost money, which I didn't have. And about that time, I was also retrenched from my job.
Oh, God.
So though there was a little bit of a retrenchment money, I was emotionally shocked by that retrenchment. More so probably than I was emotionally shocked by the scam in hindsight, but that's another story. But so I didn't go ahead with that. I basically have just accepted that scenario, and over the several years of getting tax returns, that money has reduced by the virtue of my tax return. So I haven't got the money back to me. It's gone in and paid that bill, but I still have a debt of probably about $46,000 still, and that accrues interest.
Yeah.
The last thing that happened was that I, because I was then unemployed, I asked, and they rang up at one stage saying, you know, you've got to pay this money, and you've got to pay it at, you know, over $1,000 a month, and it's got to be paid off in 12 months. And I was able to apply for hardship from the ATO for that tax bill. Now, that hardship was then again declined. However, they said they would not chase me for the money.
Now, this is obviously a traumatic experience for you in a really rough few years, but it also seems like you've tried to continue to be the person who helps other people, in that you tell this story a lot, and you talk about it to a lot of people, and you've gotten involved with support groups and media and just to tell as many people as possible so they don't make the same mistake as you.
Well, this started, about this time last year, January last year, where I decided to set up a support group. And it was really coming to the point where because I wasn't working, it was a bit easier that I went ahead with sort of going public with all this. It's actually been a very, very healing year for me. I started blogging about this topic, and each time I wrote something, I got another level of understanding. I got another sense of coming back to my self-respect. Going public allowed me to come out of the shame and the personal shame, the personal blame, and sort of regain my self-respect from this. So that's been the effect of this past year. Several months ago, an acquaintance said to me, I'd met with them sometime in that first year, and the other person came back with the feedback that I wasn't very friendly. And now I understand that I was in a space of hating myself.
Yeah.
Not trusting myself, not believing myself worthy of any engagement with anybody else.
Mm.
And so this past year, as I've talked about it, I've been able to regain all of those sort of things that I lost through all of that. So that sort of gives you a bit of the dimension of the emotional impact of it. And I've written a bit in my blog about shame and how shame it's a negative downward spiral, and society puts that on people who are scammed also.
They really do. It's something that I talk about a lot on the podcast, is the victims of scam and frauds are, in movies, they're always the bad guy. And in real life, they're always idiots. There's always something,
yes.
They're stupid, or they deserved it,
yes,
because they were foolish.
Yes.
And, of course, it's the same as being a victim of any crime.
Yes.
Yes, there is behavior you could have done differently. You know, the fact that your house wasn't secure enough or whatever it was. We should have done things differently, but that doesn't make it your fault.
Yes.
And it sounds like you've come out the other end and have, yes, learnt that lesson. If people want to read your blog, what is the address of that?
It's Romance Scam Survivor, romancescamsurvivor.org.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and telling your story, and I look forward to continuing reading the blog and your other writing that you're continuing to do.
Okay, Nick, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
For another opportunity to talk about it. It's great.
Wonderful. Thanks a lot.
For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. My name's Nicholas J. Johnson, and this has been Scammapalooza.